Welcome to the Fresh Heart Project. I'm Zareen, a consultant cardiologist and your host. Today, we're talking about why food is medicine with none other than Dr. Rupi Audler, an NHS general practitioner and best-selling author with three cookbooks. Did you know that eating well has medicinal effects? It not only protects your heart, but it can change your brain, alter your mood, support your immune function, and reduce inflammation. This is Rupi's powerful message. Through his platform, The Doctor's Kitchen, he educates us on the beauty of food and the effect it has on your health. I met him a few years ago after recommending one of his cookbooks to a patient of mine who's looking for healthy recipes. He has such a wonderful, non-judgmental, pragmatic approach to food, and most importantly, he makes eating healthily easy and delicious. Listen in to hear why he believes food is medicine. Rupi, we're absolutely delighted to welcome you to the Fresh Heart Project. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I've wanted to repay the favour for a while, so I really appreciate it and the opportunity to chat to you again.
Absolutely. Well, Rupi, I love following you on social media and I've been following you for ages, but I've really been quite distracted by Nutmeg the Pooch. How beautiful is your little dog? How can you focus having her around?
Oh, it's really tough, actually. So she's 1 year old. She just became 1 year old, actually. She's a little cavapoo. And she's tiny. She just hasn't grown. She must be the runt of the litter, because we have a friend of ours who's got a cavapoo who's 4 weeks younger, and he's three times the size of her. So she's meant to be a lot bigger, but she's added a new dimension to my life that I didn't think possible. I've never lived with an animal before. I've never had to care for something like 24/7. The arrangement I had with my girlfriend was, you know, she was going to do all the work and I was going to tolerate having a pet. And it's kind of like role reversal. Like, I take her out for walks in the evening and feed her and care for her and always pick her up and stuff. She just, like, yeah, it's reframed my perspective, actually, on eating animals as well, which I never thought I would actually get to. I've understood it from a rational point of view, but even that, like, just having her in my life is really making me question a lot of things. So yeah, that's my long-winded answer to me having a puppy for a year. I love it. It's great.
Oh, that's so interesting. And there are lots of health benefits of having pets, aren't there? And I bet you've appreciated those firsthand.
Yeah, definitely. So there's all these studies looking at how living with pets or being in constant contact with animals improves your gut microbe diversity, and why certain people who, well, there's the more extreme end of when you grow up on a farm and you have better diversity, you're less likely to experience ATP for probably a number of other reasons as well, like vitamin D and exercise and fresh water and all the rest of it. But living with an animal definitely has an impact on your microbial diversity, which I find fascinating. So I can't say that I've noticed any particular health benefits, particularly when she was disturbing my sleep for the first 6 months. If anything, it's a net negative. But yeah, no, it's very interesting to see what will happen over the next few years.
Oh, and that is absolutely fascinating, isn't it? We'll definitely go on to talk about the gut microbiome in a bit. But first, I want to congratulate you on this book. 3-2-1. For listeners who haven't seen it, who haven't read it, it's amazing. I absolutely love it. It's beautifully written. It's simple. It's accessible. It doesn't go into complex nutritional detail. It just kind of gives you just what you need to know. And so I want to congratulate you. It's a brilliant book. For people who don't know, what is the 3-2-1 concept?
Yeah, so thank you so much, first of all. And you're right, it's definitely a more streamlined and simplified book than my previous two that were quite heavy on the nutritional science, which I never want to shy away from. But I think it's very important to get to the crux of why people struggle with eating well. every day, because it's not the inclusion of particular foods or following a diet for a specified amount of time. It's about the cumulative impact of your dietary pattern over many years that compound in terms of their health benefits. And so really the root of the problem is making healthy eating sustainable for life. And that's where 3-2-1 comes from. So 3-2-1 means three portions of fruit, vegetables, nuts, or seeds per person, two servings per recipe, and only using one pan. So you can make stir fries, curries, casseroles, tray bakes, you name it, you can make it in one pan. And it, genuinely, it's the way I eat, particularly if I'm working late and I've got a shift, or you know, I come back at 8 p.m. and I don't know what to eat. The last thing you want is a complicated recipe which involves pots and pans and turning the oven on or getting the food processor out. So all the recipes are streamlined from a process point of view and to minimize washing up. But the other benefit of that is that it actually concentrates a lot of the flavors. So in the curry section, because you're just using one singular pan, you're getting the biggest impact of all these different herbs and spices. And instead of, you know, doing the tarka in like one dish and then adding it to your lentils and that, it's all in one pan. So you're not missing any flavor. And just for the audience, tarka is like the flavored oil that you put onto a traditional lentil stew, for want of a better word. And the other thing that I think is really important to recognize, and it's like an uncomfortable truth, is that we need to be eating more vegetables. And when I say more, I mean like a lot more than five a day. It's around 800 grams, which equates to 10 a day. And that's when I talk to people about that, like that's just ridiculous. Like who on earth is going to be eating mountains of vegetables and pears and nuts and all that kind of stuff? Well, you know, when you break it down meal by meal, it's a very achievable with a 3-2-1 formula, and it leaves. It also includes things like onions and pepper, and you know, when you add certain fruits to your meal as well. So you know, it doesn't need to be like a big head of broccoli every mealtime. It can be portioned, and you'd be surprised what a portion actually looks like. It's not that big, and I think it explains a lot behind a plant-focused diet in terms of the health benefits behind veganism or vegetarianism that's borne out in observational studies. And I just kind of want to bring that to as many people as possible without, you know, insinuating that you need to be 100% plant-based.
I love it. It's so accessible to everyone, no matter what your dietary preference. And that's one of the things that I really like about it. And the other thing I like about it is that it's one pan. For me, I love cooking, but I detest the cleaning up afterwards. I hate it when I have loads of like massive oven trays that I have to then clean up and tidy away. But this is another way that your book buys back time. Was this one of your aims with the book, that time is an issue and one of the pain points, you wanted to buy back time?
Yeah, massively. So one of the things that I did before formulating this book, because my aspiration was never to become an author. It was kind of just, it just landed in my email inbox. And, you know, I got an agent and then they were like, you know, we think you could do a book. And this is before there were a flux of people doing books on this subject matter in the UK, at least anyway. And so when I started writing, it was from a point of view in that I wanted people to learn about the information. The more I've done it over the last couple of years, the more I've had the pleasure of interacting with people on social media, in addition to my patient experience as well, patient doctor experience. So it's I've learned a lot about what the barriers are to eating. And it's, in a nutshell, it's motivation. Time, huge factor, and also the sort of byproducts of cooking, one of which is washing up, right? And the mental energy it takes, not just to create a meal, but deal with the horrendous state of your kitchen afterwards. And you know, that ingrains in your memory, whether you consciously are aware of it or not. You know, the thought of cooking is not just the prep time and the cook time, it's the washing up time. And in fact, you know, I think I should start a campaign for all cookbooks to have prep time, cook time, and wash time as part of the standard sort of formula. But I might do that in the next book if I write another one. But yeah, so it's for me, it was learning a lot about that. It was getting feedback from the community online and my newsletter. It was surveying thousands of people, literally thousands of people. We sent out questionnaires to find out what the barriers and pain points were. And that's where the concept of 3-2-1 was born out of. And so if we can really tackle that, then, you know, we can make cooking from scratch an easy thing to do. And then we have the opportunity to steer people in a way that's a lot more aligned with what the best health outcomes could be.
Well, I think you're perfectly carrying out your mission. I think it's a brilliant book, and I think that people should definitely pick it up and read it. It definitely buys back time. But not only that, I feel like it makes it very easy for you to do so. It's simple, and, you know, no fuss cooking, which is what I love. Now, Rupi, I just want to slightly change tack a little bit and talk about your TEDx talk. Because I listened to your TEDx talk and it's really hard hitting and really powerful. So I do think, you know, I encourage everyone to listen to it too. And you start off by talking about how as a junior doctor at a young age, you know, early 20s, you witnessed the death of a lady. And I could really relate to that because as a medical student coming out of medical school as a junior doctor, I was under the illusion that once we're on the wards, I'd be saving lives, not losing them. So how did this experience shape your philosophy on health and then in particular on prevention?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no, it was a real pleasure to do a TED Talk, to be asked to do a TED Talk, particularly in Bristol, which is where we started our culinary medicine program at the medical school. But yeah, that I think every medic has that vivid experience of unfortunately losing a patient for the first time, which is an inevitable part of the job. And I think we all go into medicine with quite a disillusioned perspective of what we're actually going to be doing on a day-to-day basis. Like, we're going to be running up and down the wards, we're going to be saving people, you know, using the defibrillator every other day, like, you know, all these sort of images that are conjured up as to what a doctor does. And in reality, we fight many battles. And I think the one against preventable disease is one that we don't do very well. And that was a stark realization for me early on. And I'm grateful that I had that realization very early, because it has certainly shaped my opinion of what I really wanted to do. Initially, when I qualified, I wanted to go into surgery. I wanted to do a lot more sort of intervention stuff. The idea of saving lives in slow motion, which is a concept that's pioneered by A.M. Panju, who's a fantastic general practitioner, that never really appealed to me. And I think, as we'll talk about a bit later on with my own anecdotal experience of ill health, It became a lot more of an attractive thing to dedicate myself to, saving lives in slow motion. And that's through those little sustainable changes that people can do themselves to protect their own health, such that we lessen the burden on the healthcare system and we can react to those acute issues, but we can prevent them as much as possible. And that's something that we don't do very well. So that experience, as unfortunate and as horrific as it was for a young individual, really has to this day shaped my opinion of medicine. Luckily for me, I can intertwine a whole bunch of my passions with cooking, with talking, communication, as well as medicine.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of Dr. Aryan Panja, actually, so I will chat to him. And I love that phrase, saving lives in slow motion. You used to actually give your patients recipes, didn't you? Sat there in the GP surgery, you used to sort of prescribe them a kind of oat recipe, for example. Did you do that quite often?
Yeah. It's funny, with that TED talk, I had to cut down so much stuff because you need to get it into, I think it's like 13 or 14 minutes or so. So I had this long story about the very first time I started giving recipes to patients. And I remember this guy coming in vividly. You know, he'd he'd want to improve his blood work, and we had to do a few things. We talked about pharmaceuticals, and I thought, why don't I talk to this guy about food? And so we talked about his breakfast, and it was, you know, your typical normal breakfast, right? Eating what his kids were eating, refined carbohydrates, high sugar, bit of juice, maybe a cup of tea. And I said, well, why don't you do oats? And he's like, I don't mind oats, we can do oats. And I went through this recipe with him. I said, add your oats, add some nuts, and these are healthy fats, and this is why you need it. It's good fiber, yada, yada. Why don't you try that? And then as he left, he asked me, how do you make oats, first of all, before you start adding all these other things to it? And I was like, and that's when the penny dropped. It was like, people don't know how to cook. Like, very simple things people don't know how to cook. So I spent a lot of time with that new perspective, going really to the basics. And I got this reputation in my general practice surgery, where I was working as a registrar at the time, of being the doctor who would talk to patients about food. And so I had this like almost expectation for some patients who came in, who were like, okay, so, you know, I've got these issues with my bloods, or this cholesterol problem, or I weight, big, you know, a very big trigger for a lot of people to come see me. You know, what can I eat and stuff? And so I spent literally so many times being late in the morning clinic, the evening clinic. So I was writing down recipes for people, was having full on conversations with them. And I just knew back then it was just like completely unsustainable. And that's where the idea of the doctor's kitchen came from. It was a way to harness the power of technology and social media to scale up information about how people can look at food in a different way and eat their way to health, using a very sort of basic approach in the kitchen, and using food as a motivator. So yeah, that was my journey from being the young registrar, giving food advice and recipes, and always running late in clinic, to starting the doctor's kitchen on YouTube and Instagram.
That's fascinating, because I had that sort of similar penny drop experience where you realize that people don't always know these terms that you talk about, that you feel like they automatically know because you've grown up in a particular way. And it's education alongside the recipes that I love that you do so well. And in your book, what you say, if I can just read a little quote, is that eating well is not just about removing foods that potentially cause disease, it's about consuming foods that amplify our defenses against getting ill in the first place. Can you tell us how this leads to the concept of eating more, not less?
Yeah, so the title for that in the last book, 3-2-1, was intentionally tongue-in-cheek, because I think particularly last year, we've been told that we have to all go on a diet because of COVID and the pandemic, and we're all sort of overweight. And of course, you know, with a third of adults pre-diabetes, the rising rates of all these different metabolic problems, weight is definitely an issue. But the perspective that I want people to understand is that our diet consists of nutrient poor, calorie and energy dense, rich items, whereas actually we need to reverse that. And the way to do that is to eat more, but eat more of the quality fruits and vegetables. It also has a veneer of being inaccessible and expensive. And that's the other thing I try and do with all my books, is to highlight those hero foods that are humble and cheap. A peasant style diet with grains and beans and red cabbage and all these different things that are literally cost pennies, but might need a bit more education and motivation around to actually prepare from scratch, are key to health. And we need to eat more of those sorts of foods. And it also ties into the principles of healthy eating that have sort of influenced every recipe that I've made from book one, which is this concept of being plant forward or plant focused. Color, so eating more of those different colors, quality fats, and that gets into a discussion about the different types of fats and the hierarchy of different fats, which I'm sure you wax lyrical about on the podcast and in clinic as well. And fiber, as well as eating whole, and so moving to the less processed and away from the highly refined products that unfortunately litter our supermarket shelves. So this concept of eating more is definitely tongue in cheek. It's actually, you know, the antithesis of what you might expect a doctor to say in terms of, well, you need to reduce your portion size and you need to cut this and you need to count these calories. It's actually, no, we need to really reframe our thinking to one that is a lot more inviting, joyful, and appreciative of all the different cultural cuisines from different cultures that we have in the UK. I mean, that's something to be celebrated and enjoyed. And I don't want people to think about healthy food in a restrictive manner.
Yeah. And I think that's excellent. And I think your book does that really well. And it's got influences from around the world. And you also talk about how the bias of modern medicine towards giving prescription medications is not because of this massive corporate conspiracy, but it's because it's actually easier to perform studies where you can pair one drug to another drug, and you can do that really robustly in an excellent, you know, conclusive manner. But it's a lot harder to do that with nutritional studies, and nutritional studies, you really have to be trained to interpret them. But I think, as you mentioned, there are some clear takeaways from the vast body of work that has gone into nutrition. And can you just tell us those main takeaway points that are clear and pretty much, you know, and indisputable?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you're right with regards to the differences between the different scientific disciplines and how easy it is to perform those robust pharmaceutical trials versus diet, which is infinitely difficult. I mean, time of day when you eat has an impact. The energy content definitely has an impact. The proportion of different macronutrients, the quality of each ingredient, the combination of the ingredients, and that's before you get to the point of and that's before you even get to the expense of performing those trials and actually getting a participant to stick with the trials, because eating isn't just something we do three times a day. It's something that we do, you know, 5-6 times a day sometimes, and we have a whole bunch of other influences on that kind of stuff. Also, the other thing is no one stands to benefit from a hugely expensive trial that demonstrates this particular diet that includes broccoli and watercress and beans is fantastic versus the trial that looks at the new and latest drug that has a clear defined outcome and that can generate billions of dollars of revenue. And obviously we need both of those, but it's definitely skewed in one direction. So the clear takeaways are those principles of healthy eating that are sort of like, I would say, my bias, but I would like to think that my bias is underpinned by a lot of the studies that I've come across and read over the last 10 years. So plant-focused eating, if you look at the number of huge observational studies, it's very clear that a plant-predominant diet yields better health outcomes in a preventative manner. You're less likely to have disease. You're less likely to suffer early death and morbidity. It's about health span as well as lifespan. The inherent issues with having an observational study to demonstrate that are that it can't be proven for an individual. There are a lot of other factors that can lead to interpretation bias, no matter how many numbers you have. And it's very hard to tease that out looking at just the data as it is in observational studies. So that's certainly one area that underpins my core belief in that we need to have more plants. And when I say more plants, I mean 85% to 90%. And we'll get to a cardiovascular point of view, but it's the Mediterranean diet, which includes fish as well. The other thing is fiber. So fiber is this fascinating field that pertains to gut health, where we're constantly talking about the microbiota, which is the population of microbes that live in and around our body, largely in our guts, but also on our skin and our mouths and the vagina, in our lungs. You know, it's incredible just how many areas of our body are populated by foreign microbes that confer benefits to the host rather than what we've traditionally thought to believe are pathogens. And so the best way to think about gut health is how to give them the food such that they thrive and create neurotransmitters, balance inflammation, modulate sugar. And the best way to do that is to give them lots of different types of interesting food in the form of fiber. And there are prebiotic fibers, which are specialized types of fibers like garlic or chicory, or even certain like the stems of asparagus, that are specific in that they have a particular beneficial effect on microbes and their diversity and allow them to flourish. But in general, all types of fiber are fantastic, whether they're coming from beans and nuts or seeds. Again, it ties in with the whole plant-focused theory as to why a plant-focused diet has so many benefits. The other thing is quality fats. Now, this is pretty divisive, depending on who you speak to, about fats and the energy in, energy out dogma that I feel is quite flawed in nutritional science. But quality fats in the form of nuts and seeds have been demonstrated in actual intervention trials, as well as those observational studies looking at the amount that is consumed in a diet, to be beneficial from a cardiovascular perspective, has been shown to be cardioprotective, which kind of flies in the face of our initial theories about calories in, calories out, and fats in general. But I think it's to do with the different ratios of polyunsaturated versus monounsaturated and the carbon chain lengths of those different amounts as well. I don't want to harbor the point too much, but every fat contains all different types of saturated and unsaturated fats in them, but in varying ratios. So it's about the ratios. But in general, people don't eat saturated fat or unsaturated. They eat food. And that's why nuts, seeds, cold-pressed oils are fantastic for general well-being. Colors. So if you look at my recipes in books or online, you'll notice they always have colors. And again, this kind of ties in with a 3-to-1 theme, because you want to try and get as many different colors as possible such that it represents the micronutrients as well as those phytonutrients in food. So micronutrients are the traditional vitamins and minerals that we've all been told that we need to have X amount of. They're essential in that we consume them from food. We can't create them ourselves. But then you've got this whole other field of phytonutrients, which are plant chemicals that you find in your humble apple, like quercetin or allicin in garlic. And we know that these have fantastic benefits, not in supplemental doses, but also in culinary doses as well, which again, you know, you can see how all this is stacking up towards a plant-predominant diet and why that might have beneficial effects. And the other thing is whole food. And I think most people understand the concept of this refined versus whole food in terms of how our food exists on a spectrum. So on one side, you have your highly refined sugar, or a flour where it's been taken from a whole wheat into this form here. And on the other side, you've got raw food like leeks or onion or potato that's pulled from the ground. Now, obviously, we don't want to just be eating raw food, because some degree of processing actually increases the bioavailability of the micronutrients and those phytonutrients, which is why when you steam a piece of broccoli, it goes this vibrant, dark, earthy green color, rather than the sort of mild green color. And that's a very simple experiment to show you that we don't need to be only eating raw food. You actually need some processing. Even chewing is a form of processing. But on the spectrum, we're far towards the process end rather than this end. And I think universally, looking at observational studies again, but also interventional studies, it's very clear we need to be eating more whole. So those are the principles of healthy eating that I describe in most of the books, and in a bit more detail, I believe, in book 2. But that's certainly what you'll get from any doctor's kitchen recipe, or be a recipe that's imbued with that sort of thinking. without having to know all the science behind it.
Yeah, and I love that you state that the concept of five a day is so ingrained into our systems through public health messaging, but actually what we should be having is 10 a day. But your book does actually make that achievable as well, because when you think 10 a day, it's really difficult to know how to get all of that in, how to get it in when you're thinking about time, when you're thinking about expense, when you're thinking about preparation. But I do urge people to look at your book and see that, you know, there are so many different ideas of how you can achieve that, which I love. And a question that I'm always asked is, does it have to be organic? And what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's a common question I'm asked. And I think in terms of priorities, my number one priority is to get more people eating plants.
Yeah.
And a secondary priority that isn't underpinned with robust science is eat organic if you can. The reasons why I say that is because I'm taking a pragmatic approach rather than one that's clearly demonstrated in studies. There are a lot of unknowns as well about pesticide use. We know certainly it has an impact on the environment, which is negative. And we know that we need to create a more sustainable method of food production that demonstrates yield benefits as well as nutrient benefits as well. But for now, I think that's a question for later. The biggest problem, the elephant in the room, if you like, is we're not eating enough of the plants to start off with. And the other thing I like to remind people of is our bodies are like incredible detoxifying machines, such that I'm here in the middle of London, I'm right next to a busy road with clear environmental pollutants that are emitted from the machines that whiz up and down. And we are still thriving. That there are, you know, many patients, and I'm not by any means promoting smoking here, but there are many patients who will ingest and inhale a known carcinogen up to 20, 30, 40 times a day sometimes for years before they succumb to something like a cancer. So having that perspective about food as well, I think is very important. We can deal with a little bit of pesticide that might be shown to be harmful, but the major issue is we're not eating enough of the vegetables themselves that confer benefits.
And I love it. You actually state in your book that our body is better able to deal with air pollution when we're eating healthy vegetables and food that nourishes our gut microbiome. It blew my mind, actually, I have to say. I hadn't heard of that before.
Yeah. So there's a couple of reasons why food can help with your natural innate detoxification mechanisms. Now, whenever anyone mentions the word detox online, you automatically think of like those teas or those tablets that you know cause you to have diarrhea and stuff. Don't ever buy any of that kind of stuff, and you don't need to, you know, do a cleanse of your body to do that. But there are two main ways in which your body can do that. So one is fiber. So one of the main ways in which we get rid of xenoestrogens and other environmental pollutants is through our poop. And so making sure you're having regular bowel habits actually removes environmental pollutants as well. And the other way is by providing cofactors for your normal detoxification process in your liver. So there's phase one, there's phase two, and those require different B vitamins, and even some phytonutrients have been shown to improve that pathway as well. That's sulforaphane that you find in broccoli. So actually having lots of greens in your diet is one way of potentially heightening your natural mechanisms. But it won't do something like charcoal, for example. That's literally something we use in an accident and emergency setting where we try and pull out those agents if you've ingested a pharmaceutical. So that's one way. I think I'm glad you brought that up, because I think a lot of people think they have to take something exogenous to our bodies to remove pollutants, whereas actually we're doing this all the time.
Yeah. And you also talked about the topic that I find absolutely fascinating, which is nutrigenomics and the fact that food can actually alter the genetic function of our cells. It blows my mind. How does this work?
Yeah. So the whole concept of nutrigenomics is about introducing stimuli that will change the expression of your genes. So not the sequence that's inherited by mother and father, but the expression of your genes can be influenced by things like stress, things like food, things like sunlight, movement. A whole bunch of things can change what happens in the nuclei of your cell and how that changes proteins that are coded, different sorts of enzymes, and ultimately whether you're putting your body in a protective state or one that is vulnerable. And I had a full conversation about this with a registered dietitian on my podcast, where she explained the different concepts. And I always thought DNA tests and genomics was kind of a little bit left field for me, and I didn't really fully understand it. But I'm more inclined towards the idea of personalized dietary regimens now than I thought of before. I think the very general principles are the same, if I'm honest, but there might be ways in which to tweak what we eat according to our DNA profile. But yeah, so the general concept of nutrigenomics is putting your body in the best state. And again, it kind of it mirrors all very much the same things that I was talking about earlier, plant forward, lots of quality fats, as well as the other things like meditation, stress relieving techniques and movement.
Absolutely. And it all boils down to the same techniques, doesn't it? These things that we're now finding in lots of different ways from lots of different sources in the body, that they actually help us. So, you know, being plant focused, eating fiber, having good fats. Now, talking about fats, as a cardiologist, I do, you're right, you mentioned earlier, talk about this all the time, and there is a causal link between having high cholesterol levels and furring up of the blood vessels in your body, and in particular, the blood vessels of the heart, what we call atherosclerosis. And historically, you know, and from studies, saturated fat is implicated, but this has been quite controversial recently, with people saying, actually, no, we should be eating more saturated fat. What is your take on this? Because I know patients come to me really confused about what they should do to protect their heart. And I think the messaging out there can sometimes be a bit confusing.
Yeah, you're right. It's a really confusing subject, even for someone who's involved in looking at the studies and, you know, listening to different opinions on this. My perspective has pretty much remained the same, in that we need to take more of a food approach rather than a micronutrient or a macronutrient approach. Because if I say to a patient, you need to eat less saturated fat, what does that actually mean? And in my head, as soon as I said saturated fat, I conjured the image of a burger. And a burger, whilst it has saturated fat in the meat, it's also got a lot of refined carbohydrates. So it's almost like the combinations of food that we consume can have an impact on cardiovascular disease. And to tease out just one element, particularly when we look at observational studies, is there's a lot of shortcomings with that. It's very negative. However, I think on the balance of things, reducing food that has that combination of refined carbohydrates, high amounts of saturated fat that are generally found in red meat, processed meats, and even other types of foods as well, will yield cardioprotective benefits. So what does that look like? Well, it looks like a plant predominant diet with some inclusion of fish. And the reason why I say inclusion of fish is because, you know, my bias, if you like, is from a Mediterranean diet, which also has fish in. And that's the only diet that has been demonstrated to have that impact on a large scale. If you ask certain vegan doctors, they will agree, actually, that a Mediterranean diet that includes fish has benefits in the Mediterranean diet. However, they're biased towards animal welfare tips them towards a vegan persuasion, which is totally fine. It depends on, you know, who you're speaking to.
You don't think we should go fully vegan for health benefits, is that right?
Yeah. So my perspective is that we should be eating a variety of different foods. A whole food plant-based diet definitely ticks all the boxes from that perspective. The need to go 100% plant-based, I think, is more of an ethical question rather than an environmental question as well, rather than a purely human health and nutritional one. I also think that, that there is this pervasive myth that if you eat meat in any, like even small quantities, then you're going to be damaging your health. And I don't think that's right. I don't think we have the evidence to say if you have a steak every 2 or 3 weeks that you're going to be putting your health at a significant harm. I don't think that's correct. But when it comes to the question of, you know, should you be eating more saturated fat? Definitely not. We definitely shouldn't be eating more saturated fat. The main issue is that we eat too much of the animal products that have high amounts of saturated fat. And saturated fat might just be one of the elements that is causing harm. There's also nitrates in there. There's also the way we prepare the meat in terms of the carcinogens that are released from grilling the food. There's a whole bunch of other proteins that can damage your gut microbiota when consumed in large amounts. Like it's not just about the saturated fat. And I think the other thing is what we do know is when you consume high amounts of saturated fat from all those multiple sources, it raises your level of LDL cholesterol. And there's this myth that, you know, it doesn't matter if your LDL cholesterol is raised. That's not to do with cardiac risk. That's wrong. You know, if your LDL cholesterol, you've got to think about it from an engineering point of view as well. If you have high amounts of a lipoprotein that carries cargo in the form of cholesterol cursing around your body in an environment where you've got inflammation as a result of maybe stress or high sugar or, you know, a whole bunch of other factors, then the likelihood of that cargo landing into your artery and causing that inflammatory atherosclerotic process is obviously going to be higher. So LDL raised is definitely going to be a risk factor. And if your saturated fat increases your LDL, then you're going to have an increased risk. It doesn't make sense to say anything outside that. What is also true is that you can have a raised LDL and have no cardiac disease. That's true as well. But that doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't worry about high LDL. No, we should always try and minimize risk. It's a very complicated field, but one that I'm glad that we're clarifying.
No, I agree. And I agree with what you said. It's the entirety of the diet, isn't it? If you have, you know, a burger on the odd occasion, then providing that for the majority of the time you eat, as you say, a plant-focused diet, which is high in fiber and high in good fats, then that's absolutely fine. And it leads us onto this concept of good food versus bad food. And that, I think, is really tricky because it assigns blame, I think, to people. And when you then have that odd packet of Haribos on a night shift or on a difficult work day, or when you're, you know, busy with the kids, then you can feel this real sense of blame as well. And I love that you in your social media put a packet of Haribos occasionally there to say, you know what, we all have this on occasions. What do you think about good food and bad food? I mean, I've always thought this is a tricky concept and a troublesome one. How about you?
Yeah, you know, it's a very tricky concept because as someone who has spent a lot of time on social media, I witness the good and the bad. So when I put out healthy meals and you know, content about how you can improve your health, I'm speaking to a particular person or range or demographic of people who are really interested in healthy eating and who have genuine intentions about improving their health. However, as we've noticed over the last few years with Instagram and other picture-based social media platforms, there is a growing concern around eating disorders and an unhealthy obsession with healthy eating. And I did a post recently about how I describe myself as just a big microphone. And that microphone is great because you can get to lots of people, but it also means you're going to get collateral issues in the form of my content being presented to someone for whom it's not appropriate. And really, we need to encourage people to be filters of their own digital landscape, because it can't, at the moment, I'm just a microphone and all I can be is a microphone. I can't be a specific, you know, laser targeted weapon, if you like, you know, where I can target certain people with the right information. And I think that's why I steer clear of black and white messages of good and bad food. Yes, certainly we know the attributes of a diet that is generally going to be healthy. But that isn't to say that if you include some foods that are in the bad list, quote unquote, that, you know, it's going to yield incredible health issues in the future. I think food is there to be enjoyed first and foremost. You know, we've got Eid coming up. We've just had Easter. We had Christmas a few months ago. I've got my birthday in a couple of months. You know, I want to have food used as pleasure and food as something to enjoy, as well as food to fuel me and to ensure that I'm functioning correctly.
Absolutely. And firstly, I really applaud you for your really sort of mature approach to social media. You really use it very effectively as a tool, and you openly say, if this triggers anything within you, if my feed triggers you, then unfollow me. And it's a really open, honest, refreshing way to approach social media. And so I really want to thank you for that, because I think it's really important for people like yourselves to say that. And secondly, you mentioned Eid, and it is currently the month of Ramadan. So before we move on, I do want to discuss fasting very quickly. So you have a wonderful chapter in your book about fasting. It's a very confusing topic, even to me. Can you tell us, in a nutshell, why can fasting be beneficial?
Yeah, it's a very confusing topic. And it's confusing because sometimes you read academic papers and they confuse the terms, right? So intermittent fasting can refer to so many different forms of fasting, whether it be 16:8, 5:2, even like a 12-hour fast. That can all be intermittent fasting. So the terminology that we use is very vague, and it needs to be a lot more defined, particularly when you realize that certain forms of fasting are beneficial for certain people versus other forms of fasting that could be at the detriment of people's health. And I know this intuitively. Like, if I was to do a water fast for 3 or 4 days, my gut would have a party. Like, it just wouldn't be very good from an acidic point of view. And, you know, maybe I could practice it a few times and ramp it up slowly to a point where I can tolerate it a bit more. But I don't think that's going to have a beneficial effect, because I've done some personal experiments where my thyroid function is disturbed. It affects my concentration. Whereas certain people do those forms of fasting and they thrive. So the overarching point I want to get across to people is fasting is a potential great therapeutic tool. The issue we have is that we don't know the dose of fasting and what dose is appropriate for which patient. That's the overarching message. When it comes to the benefits of fasting, there are potential benefits from a number of different reasons. Insulin sensitivity, so improving one's sensitivity to the hormone that regulates sugar, as well as fat deposition as well, the regulation of fuel in our muscle cells. So that's one thing. And given that we have an issue with metabolic syndrome in the UK and globally as well, it's a very important potential tool in our clinical toolbox. The other thing is, and this relates to weight as well, and weight maintenance and sugar balance and stuff like that. The other big point is around longevity. So when you fast, what happens is a process called autophagy is upregulated. And autophagy, in simple terms, is the recycling of components from your cell into new, spanking, brand new cells. So it's kind of like if you imagine a highway of cars, and on this highway you have a brand new Ferrari, a brand new Mercedes-Benz, but on the same one, you have a bunch of old cars that's been hanging around and causing smoke to go everywhere and, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So it's basically the process of removing those cars with a big forklift, taking them to the dump, shining off all their materials, making them all brand spanking new, and then making a whole set of new Ferrari cars to put in your highway. That's essentially autophagy, the process of autophagy. And that leads to some longevity benefits, reduced inflammation benefits, and potential prevention of cancer benefits as well. Yeah. So in a nutshell, there are a few things that I think are beneficial with regards to fasting, but we just don't know the right therapeutic dose and whether people can actually maintain methods of fasting. But fasting is very important. As you just mentioned, you know, Eid and Lent, and every culture has a fasting process, which is very interesting. I think there's definitely something in our evolutionary history that has heightened to us the importance of fasting. I think we need to reestablish a relationship with it.
Yeah, fascinating. I find it fascinating. When I was burnt out, tried to fast in Ramadan, and I felt absolutely horrendous. And I like what you say about doing what's right for you, because fasting is a great tool for people for whom it works, and it doesn't work for everyone, and it's not for everyone. And so for people who are ill, for people who are burnt out even, it can be counterproductive. So it's knowing your body and listening to your body. I think that's really important.
Absolutely.
Now, Weepy, I've been a fan of yours from the outset. I prescribed your book once, and my patient came back with better yeah, blood pressure and better heart rhythm issues. And, you know, I took all the credit. Thank you very much. And you have very much sort of coined the term food is medicine. Do you believe that food is medicine?
Very much so. Yeah. So I did a daily podcast episode on this recently, and it was about the concept of medicine in itself. What do we mean when we say medicine? And I think if you have a narrow definition of what medicine is, i.e. the prescription of pharmaceuticals, the performance of surgery, then food doesn't qualify by that standard at all. However, medicine is the use of substances and interventions that prevent disease and treat illness. And I think by those definitions, food qualifies as medicine in the same way sleep, exercise, talking therapy, just conversation. Sometimes it can be touch that can be truly medicinal to people. So I think, you know, clarifying exactly what we mean by food as medicine is important, but it definitely is a clinical tool, and it's certainly a medicine that I think has its roots in cultural, and certainly our cultural history, but certainly it should be recognized as such. Food is not a pill, yeah, but food is medicine.
Yeah, absolutely, guys. Get all the books. I've got them all and they're brilliant. And I feel that there's been a real evolution in your approach. I can see it. The first is very much the kind of the blueprint, the message, the call to action. And then the second is, right, a very systems-based approach. And then the third is so much more practical in terms of, right, now we've actually got to do it. So this is a roadmap almost for doing it. So yeah, thank you for writing your books. It's really interesting that you became a very accidental author, but they've certainly done so much good in the world. I've got some quick fire questions in three, 2-1 approach. Did you see what I did there?
Okay.
So you're going to a desert island, Rupi, and you can only take three vegetables. Which ones would you take and why?
Oh, okay. Oh, this is a tough one. So I would take fennel. I love fennel. I would take chickpeas. And I would also take, what else would I take? Oh, it'd have to be broccoli, Tenderstone broccoli in particular. Yeah.
Interesting. Fennel, chickpeas, yeah. Tenderstone broccoli. Amazing.
Yeah.
Two, you can take two spices. Now, we didn't talk much about spices, but you can take two of your favorite spices. And so which ones would you take and why?
Fennel and cumin. Because I think fennel and cumin match each other beautifully as a blend. Cumin brings me back to that Middle Eastern vibes. Fennel is Mediterranean, but you know, combination is it's great.
Yeah, and you couldn't live without those, could you? If they were just whipped from the spice spectrum. Brilliant. And finally, number one. What is your one favorite dish that you would take?
My favorite dish I would take would probably be my mum's almond chicken curry. Actually, it's delicious. It's really, really good, and I would have that every day happily.
Is that the recipe that's in the book?
It is,
the almond chicken curry. I was looking at that, thinking, oh, maybe we'll do that this weekend. So yeah, you've inspired me. Thank you, Rupi. Thank you so much. This part of the podcast now is over, but I really just want to say again that I love your cookbook. It gives back. It's the cookbook that gives back for me. It gives back time, it gives back money, it gives back energy, and ultimately, which is your aim, which is to give back health. So it's a wonderful cookbook, and I encourage everyone to take a look at it and try out the recipes. So thank you, Rupi.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for tuning in. If someone you know could find this episode helpful, then please do share. You can check out all the other episodes on our website, freshheartproject.com. We would be really grateful if you could comment, subscribe, and give this a 5-star rating. This helps us get the Fresh Heart message to more people. The content of this episode is not a substitute for medical advice from your healthcare professional. Remember, be kind to yourself, and small, sustainable steps create great change.
This podcast is produced by Lion Mountain Entertainment, a subsidiary of Morgan Archway Limited.